Forged a Narrative.
Everybody, welcome to Forged Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. This is episode 169. We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. I got Andrew Whitaker and Adam Abramowitz.
Oh, sweet, bro. 169, bro.
Okay, did you hear what he said, Andrew?
And Ricky Addington.
I am literally at a loss for words now.
I think they've all been said. Probably yes. Not. How y'all feeling?
I'm feeling great. I haven't been on the show in 2 weeks. I've missed the last two episodes. So a couple good things for listeners. One, I'm back, so knowledge bombs will be dropped. Two, episode 169, it's really about making sure that everyone is getting something out of this. So I'm excited. Let's do this show.
Once every 100 episodes, that's what we talk about.
That's right. Once every 100 episodes, we're just going to, we're really going to kind of maybe invert what we would normally do and kind of really get exciting.
Parents, I apologize for my Neanderthal friends here that are recording the show, but we have more important things to talk about, Paul.
We're on the eve of Warzone Atlanta. We're recording on Wednesday. Thursday is, of course, tomorrow. And then Friday, we're doing the first events. Get really opening up and getting into more of that kind of convention atmosphere of the weekend. I'm really excited. I'm actually, some folks are coming in on Thursday. Man, I may break away and have some dinner. You may start early. Start even earlier than Friday. Yeah.
I told my bosses that I was leaving work at noon on Friday. I had to go pick up my friend Adam at the airport at 1 o'clock. So
Named Adam?
Yeah, I do. And I might put it on Facebook Live. You might check out the Forged the Narrative Facebook. I'll put me picking up Adam from the airport on Facebook Live.
I'm glad you mentioned that because we're going to have some streaming of the weekend through. It's all going to depend on what the hotel's overall bandwidth is, about how many sources that we have streaming. But the links will be off of the Forged Narrative webpage and off the event pages for the weekend. So we will be streaming at least one table, maybe two. We will be going live on Facebook from time to time, keeping things flowing. I've even arranged, we're going to have a contest for people on site at the event to post their pictures to Facebook. So people help them maybe win a prize on site by liking and sharing pictures that you see coming from the event.
Where are they going to find these pictures, Paul?
Post them up to Forged Narrative, Warzone Atlanta Facebook page, the event pages, their personal pages. Anyway, they'll be everywhere. We'll be able to find them. Just help them post. We're going to enable them too. It's going to be a cool little area for them to take pictures.
I think we need a hashtag for Warzone this year.
It's actually funny. So speaking of hashtags and social media and promoting events and whatnot, I mean, obviously Warzone's getting a lot of national press. We're going to talk about tonight about people talking about their lists that they're bringing, talk about the bounty system. We're going to talk about all of that. But just kind of leading into it, this week I was working on my wedding website. For those of you who don't know, I'm engaged and we were doing stuff on the wedding website, and we have to pick our wedding hashtag. And I just thought it was the most nonsensical thing that everybody's like, well, you need a wedding hashtag. And I didn't understand why that was essential, but really it's actually a really, really great idea because if you post something on social media with that hashtag, it automatically centralizes and aggregates all of those posts so that anybody can go on hashtag Warzone Atlanta or hashtag WZA on Twitter, on
WZA
Instagram,
is
on Facebook.
What we're going to suggest. Yep.
So wait a second. Like, you click that button and then all of those aggregated posts are right there. So make sure anybody who's coming to the event, anybody who's commenting on the event, if you're following the live stream and have some pithy commentary, to make sure you hashtag it, because I imagine I'm not going to be productive on Monday. I'm just going to be sitting around kind of recapping in the event.
A few things happened to me this week that I'd like to talk to you guys about, kind of get it off my chest, if that's all right. I cleaned an obscene amount of junk out of my airbrush, the airbrush tip specifically. Like stuff, it was like the Ghost of Christmas Past came out of there, maybe some coconut stuff from Oak Island. I mean, that's how far deep it went in the nozzle of this airbrush, of things that just had been in there.
Before we get into it, I have three questions. I think you pretty accurately described how disgusting this airbrush was. What is the normal pressure that you run your compressor at?
Wide open.
Wide open.
What's the max? Isn't that what it's supposed to do? Wide open max.
No, I think I've got it set at about 20 PSI.
Okay. And you're in Atlanta, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And then...
is that a humidity question, or are you leading?
Yes, absolutely.
Checking weather.com for the barometric pressure.
Yeah. So if y'all live in the South, if y'all live in the South, like I'm in New Orleans now, I was in South Carolina, but I mean, it's all the same. Humidity's high here. You need a little bit more pressure than 20 PSI. So, you know, Paul's house might be pristine and clear of humidity. The next question I'm going to ask. So, Paul, what do you use to clean your airbrush?
Well, an old toothbrush and some paper towels.
Okay, that's terrible.
There's a few different things.
Okay, hold on. Let me. I am mad that you're saying this is terrible because that's my exact technique as well. So,
let me break it down where some of the clog. How I discovered the clog. I'm painting these tanks for a buddy, and I use Enchanted Blue, which is a color they don't make anymore. And the color they say matches Enchanted Blue does not actually match Enchanted Blue. The Vallejo Magic Blue, nowhere near the Enchanted Blue color either. There's no Enchanted Blue. So when Enchanted Blue, when they stopped selling it, I went and bought about, five, six, eight little pots of Enchanted Blue, thinking it's going to last for the next foreseeable future, and it will. But since I don't use it that often, the paint starts to dry. And when I'm pouring the bottle of paint into the reservoir for the airbrush, I've learned that there are flakes of the paint that have dried on the other parts of the bottle that have floated their way back into the paint are going with the pour, and then they're clogging up the nozzle of the airbrush. So that's I discovered the problem. And then once you got past that, I then discovered the silt levels of past poor airbrush cleaning techniques.
Yeah, you got to clean your airbrush. It's kind of a pain in the butt because you think that everybody tells you that an airbrush is quicker and it's going to make your life easier. You'll paint an army in 3 hours as opposed to 3 years or whatever it is. And to some extent, it's true. Once you figure out the production process that works best for you, you can cover a lot of ground quickly. You can do a lot of things a lot quicker, as opposed to base painting. If you're just like priming your models and then base painting them with a big brush, you can prime your models or do your base coat very easily with an airbrush. But if you're doing more than that, like I do, and I know Ricky does, I do the airbrush for 50% of the work that I do is airbrush, and the other 50% is all edge highlighting, weathering, and it takes time, and you need to invest in a good airbrush. And even if you don't have a good airbrush, if you have a kind of a entry level airbrush, sorry, Paul, if I'm getting up to off topic, I'm going to wrap it up soon. You have to take care of it. You have to clean it. Badger makes a product called Reg Dab, which is Badger spelled backwards. It's called Reg Dab Needle Juice. And this stuff will save your life if you are new to airbrush.
Isn't that heroin?
We're jumping around a little bit, so let me just kind of stick on one thing at a time with this, because this can be, especially if you don't have an airbrush or you just recently started using one. We've ran in a circle, I think, on some of this topic. So let's just dial it back just a little bit. Problem one was not being aware of particulate matter in the paint, because the airbrush, when you got to think about it, depending on the size of the needle and how precise you want to be with the trigger, where you pull all the way back or just use it for thing, little try to detail work, is that there's only so much space that can go through that nozzle. Right. So air, you could hear the air going all day long, but you may not be spraying anything. And then you may think that you may not know where the problem is. Like, well, I'm getting air, I'm getting some water there. Where's my paint not coming through? The consistency of the paint and what else may be in there is a huge factor into maybe your success with the airbrush. And I didn't notice this until I'm cleaning it out and I'm seeing down in the bottom of the well, everything else is coming out clean like I expect. But I see like these little, almost like tabs, like little flat pieces of dried paint that it's not behaving like paint. It's not sticking to the pot, but you can just kind of use your mind then to think, well, I bet this is further down the nozzle.
It's coagulate.
Going further down the nozzle.
It's coagulate.
So taking the nozzle apart, you start to see colors where they're not supposed to be colors. Like that's supposed to be bare metal of this. That's supposed to be water or nothing there. And then anyway, it was a bit of a nightmare. And when to go clean it from there.
You should make a good practice. If you use your airbrush for what Paul is describing and talking about is what I refer to as coagulate. It's essentially when the pigments bind together because there's no more moisture to keep them separate. So what Paul is describing is that gunk, that stuff that gets stuck inside of the nozzle. is essentially when you shut off your compressor and your airbrush goes dry and there's no more, or you allow the moisture that's inside to evaporate, the pigment retains and the pigment media the medium shrink and they coagulate just like blood does, and they form a ball of gunk inside of your airbrush. And it usually doesn't happen where you can see it. As Paul was saying, it usually happens inside of the barrel of the airbrush.
Well, the nozzle of the airbrush is three or four different components depending on your airbrush.
Right. So, but it's not even a nozzle, Paul. It's actually the barrel. So it's that point.
The coagulated, we'll use that paint, was that it had basically flown through down the needle and started to build up a wall there right at the end of the nozzle.
So So it starts there and it works its way back. So with paint like this, you're absolutely right, Paul. The clog started at the tip, and it always does. And that's what happens if you don't clean your airbrush and lubricate it properly. What you need to do, and in a case like this where it's gotten so bad that it starts to gunk up the actual barrel of the airbrush, where the actual paint is being siphoned up and through the needle, what you need to do is, and we mentioned this a few minutes ago, is get a good lubricator. And you don't need a lot of it. I use Badger Reg Dab. So it's Badger spelled backwards. You pour a drop of that in there. And what I do is most airbrushes have a fastening. I'm just going to grab my airbrush here. They have a fastening unit on the back. You unscrew that. You take the needle out. When you have your lubricant inside or your airbrush cleaner, I love Vallejo's airbrush cleaner. Games Workshop also makes one. Theirs is a little bit thicker. It takes a little bit more time, where Vallejo is a little bit more concentrated. And if you look at the Badger Reg Dab, it's more so, but it also acts as a lubricant. What you want to do is, once you get that fastener off, you take your actual airbrush needle and you scrub it, and you're using that to scrub the insides of the entire airbrush unit to move free all of that coagulate that Paul was describing earlier, whether it's in the tip or inside of the barrel or the siphon or even further back, which you really don't want, but it moves it around. And what you'll see is, after you start doing that, you take a little bit of water, and if you're airbrushing, you should have some water in a droplet nearby. Just put one drop in there, fasten it back, and then bubble it up. See what color is coming out.
This isn't something that you do every time. This is something that you would, this is part of your routine maintenance that you should do whenever it's the appropriate series of blocks for you. I break down my airbrush and clean it like this maybe about once a year.
So, Paul, you're wrong. I'm sorry. How often are you airbrushing a week?
Not very much.
If you are painting and busting out your airbrush at least once a week, you should be cleaning it once a week. Otherwise, it's going to get blocked up and you're going to destroy your airbrush and you're going to spend $200 for it.
Well, this airbrush I got for 40% off at Hobby Lobby or Michael's is 5 years old. And this is my routine. But obviously, not, I'm also willing to admit the routine is broken down, because I did have to get a little bit more serious. I'd essentially give my my airbrush mouth to mouth during this cleaning.
You shouldn't have to, and that's what I'm getting to. Like, because a thin line between mouth to mouth and like losing a $200 or $40 utensil that you've used once is extreme. Like, it, you don't want to take care of it. You have to take care of it. Just like your car, you lubricate your car, you put oil in your car, you put gasoline in your car.
That's the takeaway from windshield wipers. Yeah, that's the takeaway from this, is that you do want to put in the maintenance to prevent this from happening. And then these are some of the where the gotchas could occur. Like, your airbrush could look shiny and clean, but you could have a ball the size of a BB or whatever right there in that nozzle, because either the way you clean it, your toothbrush doesn't get down there, or it's already dried well enough to where the water that you put down in there, the airbrush. I use Vallejo airbrush cleaner also. I got a big bottle of it right next to the airbrush, and as soon as I get done,
it's the best.
Squirt it right in there. That's the big takeaway, is to do this maintenance, because when you're using the airbrush to be a time saver, and if you're fighting with it for whatever reason, like I was fighting with it this time, because the paint, I just poured the paint right out of the bottle, went in with all its gunk for being an 8-year-old paint or whatever, and that wasn't the best thing to do, which cost me more time. Then it made me notice this other issue, which caused me more time. it's all worked out now, and the six Rhinos and the Storm Talon are, or sorry, Stormhawk Interceptor are all base coded now, so it's all good. But there was some cussing, a little bit of an adult vernacular, and I've got some more blue paint on my pants.
Wait, did you say bad words?
Almost everything I wear casually has some blue paint on it from the last 5 or 6 years I've been painting these Ultramarines.
So I'm just going to throw it out there. If you ever have a question about the airbrush, please ask me. I'm not the best airbrusher in the world by any means, but I understand the fundamentals. And
there are some parts on there that I think that are easy to miss, and that's where I think you need to be aware. Like, I strip the thing down. Yeah. Once a year. So once a year to me, I'm not going to even get intimately familiar with all the parts there.
I strip mine down at least once a day. And granted, I'm airbrushing. It depends on the day and depends on the schedule, but like, I could be airbrushing for 4 hours a day. So I have to, because it's just, you're pumping that much air through. You have to, the more air that you push through the airbrush. And if you're working, all of our listeners in the Southeast, if you're down here, you have to push more air through the airbrush to get it to work, because it's more humid, it's heavier air. If you're living in Vermont and you're working at like 15 PSI and you're golden, you're winning a golden demon just by owning an airbrush. You know, it's just things that you need to consider. It's not the same for everybody. It's definitely environmentally focused.
I think your point about taking care of the tools, though, it's like brushes. Taking care of good brushes, if you got them, it makes your when you do get time, even if you do only have an hour a week or maybe an hour every 2 weeks to sit down, you can make the most of it when everything is in your working order.
I know Andrew doesn't airbrush. We had a very, very important conversation with our friendship.
That's not entirely true, but I don't airbrush. Like, I don't airbrush detail work. I don't highlight with airbrush, but all my base coating is done that way. I literally sat in silence for 12 minutes listening to you and Paul talk about how often you need to clean your airbrush. I'm literally looking at mine on the shelf being like, I haven't washed you in like 6 years.
Right. Like, I don't know. I'm with you, though. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, don't – anyway.
Yeah, like, wash your tools and stuff.
It does need to work.
That's why I
– You probably have a keep. Yeah, you probably have a big ball of dried red paint just waiting to mesh. You're gonna be painting that – whatever that last thing is, you're done. You're thinking, this is the last thing I'm going to do for the Blood Angels for a while, and it's going to not work for you.
See, here's the – I think, don't put that bad juju on you.
I'm not – That's number one. I'm not trying to. I'm prophesizing.
Number two, I think that this is important. I really think that, especially on this particular episode, that if, you know, it's really unfortunate when maybe one person has success, you know, with their whatever they're doing, while another person would be in, you know, not as successful.
All right,
you know,
Let's bring it back around where everyone's getting satisfied. Yeah,
let's get everybody satisfied on this particular episode. And let's officially
talk about Warzone. I finally got my White Dwarf. I'm going to talk about the White Dwarf. There's a section in the White Dwarf to where it's early on. They've started to put like a rating system for whatever it is they want to talk about. Like, this one has the highs and lows of Aramon, and the previous one had the highs and lows of the Gene Stealer cults. Somebody got Ricky. Can you bring that? Pull it up.
Let's see here. Gene Stealer cults. That's page 5 of your October 2016 White Dwarf.
Nerds.
Nerd.
Well, what it does, it gives you like these, this is a reason why you would love them. And these are the pros and cons of the, and this is not, wait, dude, it's not game, it's not stat related. Ricky, would you mind?
Okay. So we're on the Gene Stealer cult one. Is that the one we're talking about?
This is one section. This is a quarter of a page in White Dwarf that I think helps sell it for me.
A quarter. It is not a quarter. It's like an eighth. Let's see here. Low biomonstrosities. The Gene Stealer cults are an insidious menace, and as such, aren't backed up by tyrannid bio creatures such as Carnifexes. Well, not yet, at any rate. Ellipsis. You know what? Good job, White Dwarf. But that ellipsis should have 4 periods because it's at the end of the sentence. Come on, get your life together. All right. High mining productivity. Gene Stealer cults often establish themselves on industrial worlds where their members haul cargo and mine asteroids with fanatical zeal. Their work ethic does them credit. Well, that's good.
See? I mean, come on.
What an endearing thing to say. Like, what a bunch of blue-collar workers these guys
That's
are.
That's really what these guys are. You know, like, these guys are pro-union.
These guys are the Rust Belt of the universe.
Yeah.
Read the other high.
I mean, okay. Wait, we're going to skip the next low, which is Faith in the Emperor?
We'll end out on the low. Well, you spoil it. Never mind.
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry. Anyway, high, number of arms. For millennia, humanity has averaged slightly less than 2 arms per person. The gene stealer cults are rife with hybrids possessing rather more. So, good for them.
I thought that section was brilliant.
It's fun. That's what I've been liking about the new White Dwarf. It's little... I swear, it's like I joked that I had to go, you know, grab mine from the library, also known as, you know, the bathroom. But, you know, I set it there and it's like you pick it up and you're always finding something when you go through it. It, you know, where it's not just that catalog like the last version of it was. They just tons of stuff in this thing.
This one, the one I have, I'm looking at in my hand right now, they do a high and low on Arum, and I won't read it, but I hope they continue that trend of things. I think it's just fun. It's something interesting. Helps bridge the back because the old White Dwarfs were very catalog-y. They were just simply now look. They're trying. I mean, this is a catalog too. But they made it enjoyable. It is now a magazine that I want to read. And I think their team here is putting together a quality piece of magazine. It's a magazine that does. It sits perfectly right there in the parlor or the reading room or the lavatory, whatever, in wherever you call it. From wherever you are,
it's a million times better, and it only had to be 4 times better because it went from weekly to monthly.
Yeah, but no, they've knocked it out of the park. In this, yeah.
that is an interesting thing. I just think it's remarkable that they went from a quarterly to a weekly to a monthly progressively.
They also go over the hero bases in this one. You know, remember I said still be in the catalog. Man, as a competitive gamer, I can't be about making my figures easier to shoot. On purpose.
You don't want to put him on those big 3 steps there on top of a pipe.
Oh, my HQ guy, hey. The guy that probably has invisibility.
Hey, but if he's up there, he gets line of sight.
Here's my thing. Like, as a competitive gamer, if you're playing for the overall and to make your army look better, do it.
I'm like, mostly 100%. Joking about that. Like, I've had conversations with people. Like, look, my miniatures are on senior basis. If you're going to try to shoot my guardsman behind this rhino because you can see his head because I'm on a cool base, I'm going to have a word with you. That's like entry-level life talk.
I've got a Samael. I've got Samael up on, like, I got metal rod, and he is probably a good 6 inches up off the tabletop, and only once has anyone ever pointed that out and actually used it against me. In any other game I've ever played in, people are like, no, man, I know where he's supposed to be. You're fine. I mean, he's, you know, what? Typically, I've got a 2-up re-rollable jink on him anyway, so it doesn't matter. But, you know, like, it takes that special kind of someone to just be like, you know what? No. And shoot at you.
I mean, I think that happens. That happens a lot. You know, I at least in my experience, where, oh, well, you put your Marine on that really fancy resin base, and so now I can see him. So,
yeah.
Because what's the alternative? Like, you know, maybe if you had used a different base, I wouldn't be able to see you. But we have no way of knowing that whatsoever.
I think you should have a conversation with your opponent if you think it's an issue. Or if you want to play it any differently than it is true line to whatever it is, you should just have a certainly, conversation. That's it. That's all.
I certainly agree with that. It's just, you know, I don't want to fault people off the bat without, you know, because it's manipulable the other way too. Like, well, you know, if I was on a regular base, you wouldn't be able to see me, so you can't shoot at me. Okay, buddy.
Yeah, maybe yeah. I think that's
the key right there. Yeah, I mean, that's the key is, like, you can't play that card.
Yeah.
If your opponent says, you know what, I wouldn't have been able to see that, go for it, you know. But if you pull that card, if you try to play that card, you're...
To quote the great Pam Poovy from Archer, if your aunt had balls, she'd be your uncle, you know. So just, yes. Whatever. I don't really have the the hypothetical skills to address what you just said to me.
I think, like, as a nation, we should all live by Pam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's exactly what we did this week.
Sploosh.
I don't want to take us off too far on that, obviously. The plastic bases they've been coming out with, not a terrible way. If you're the kind of person that wants a scenic base up your whole army, not a terrible way to get them.
It's funny that you mentioned it, because they previously they had a resin / gravel composite kit that was released, I guess, sometime in early 2015 or maybe late 2014. It was the I forget the name of the board. They also had, like, the big plastic battle boards, Realms of Battle, and what they had were resin chips essentially that you would glue to the top of a basic 25 millimeter base, and then you'd glue your miniature on top of that resin. And I bought a couple of these packs, and I really liked them, but I was always like, man, there's got to be a better way to do this. And sure enough, man, these new plastic bases are great. They are really great. And they're accessible. They're really flexible. And like you said, I mean, I know a lot of people, especially some friends of mine who have large, very, very large Marine armies, or, you know, maybe 1,500 to 2,500 points of kind of an ancillary, this is my Space Wolf army that I play with occasionally. And they just can't be bothered to rebase their entire Imperial armies. But with these new plastic kits, it's never been easier. Just snap the old guys off, super glue them down. And especially when it comes to Marines, if you're not playing on 32s, man.
Well, it's hard to imagine them now on anything else. Like, how did they ever look and fit on anything else?
Absolutely. I mean, that it's so much better. And literally, especially because I was kind of on the cutting edge of that. I mean, I had my entire Blood Angels army put onto 32s within like a month of those bases coming out. And I remember when I first started playing with people with those, they were like, what is that? And they got down and they picked up these models and they're like, this looks so much better. How did we ever like exist before this? And I'm like, I have no idea. I have no clue at all.
So 32s were the absolutely 100% the catalyst of why I moved away from playing a Xenos army to Space Marines.
Yeah, that's legitimate. I'm
not kidding. I mean, like, Horus Heresy was played a secondary factor to that, like reading the books. But when you could put a 3-up armor toughness 4 model on a 32 millimeter base and then space them out in a meta where, now we have to think back in the day where Tau was very strong. We had Tau and Eldar.
Like last February.
You know. Yeah, literally a year ago.
Exactly.
This is not back. So, wax poetic. Don't wax poetic way for 18 months ago.
Back in the day.
You young whippersnappers weren't around for this, but.
Back in the yonder years. Back before episode 169.
Pepperidge Farm remembers.
Closer to episode 69, if memory serves.
So we can, though, and here's why we can. Because Games Workshop has been moving at a rapid pace in the past 12 months. I mean, they're really.
You don't actually have to defend like us giving you crap about this.
Well, I'm going to defend it because our listeners need to hear it for once and for all. Adam is actually right about something. But, I mean, yeah, if you're not playing Space Marines on 32 millimeter bases, you're doing yourself a disservice. I'm doing a giant Blood Angels army right now. Everything's on 32. And Paul actually referred me, a friend of his who wanted a Death Watch army painted, and he sent me the exact bases that you guys are talking about. And they've gotten mixed reviews online. I think they're fantastic. I mean, I think they are phenomenal. You know, compared to resin bases, they're plastic. They're a little bit easier to work with, you know, and
if you're working with plastic glue, you don't have to switch to super glue. I mean, there's some.
Exactly. But beyond that, I think that
that is a first world problem if I've ever heard one. Just, I'm sorry. I was a little bit dazed for there for a second. My eyes were rolling over. But like, goodness gracious. Hey, guys, I know what you're thinking. Do I really have to switch my glue types right now?
It may be sitting here right next to me on the – who has it been like
– minding my own business.
Who has it been 2 feet from the remote control and does not want her to get up and get it?
That's why I had kids.
I'm not saying it's not a legitimate problem. I'm just saying like we're like a little bit spoiled. Like, oh, so, I was having a great night, but then I had to stand up and grab the regular super glue.
So anyway, in all, like, the jokes are hysterical. Andrew, you're a funny person, but the bases provide you just enough freedom.
Since sarcasm.
I'm going to get back to the hobby talk that matters. Like, the bases provide you just enough freedom to make them what you want them to be. If you want them to be dusty, you can make them dusty. If you want them to be muddy, you can make them muddy. If you want them to be rusty, you can make them rusty. You could pile on globs of Vallejo texture paint or Typhus Corrosion, or I know Games Workshop makes some texture style paints, like something Astro Granite or something like that. You can do that with these bases and make them even more unique.
They just released some of the larger pots of their texture paint. The texture paint is good. It does exactly what it's supposed to do. And having the larger pots, you could get, because really even one pot, if you use it kind of sparingly, and especially if you're using on some of these bases that already have the detail on it, it'll go a long way. But even now they're larger containers. I mean, you'll get many squads done, use sparingly.
100%.
I feel like I need to point this out. Like, I'm not one to hold a grudge, but I remember a year ago when I was putting together some Legion of the Damned, and I was going to put them on 32 millimeter bases, and a certain podcaster who I'm not going to name said, well, you know, Ricky, they deep strike, so the smaller bases are actually probably the way to go.
I'm just going to guess that was Paul.
I said I'm not going to name names, all right?
So that I roll at that hugely for a couple of reasons. One, if you're deep striking on midi bases, it can be helpful, right? Because you can conceivably you can fit into a tighter spot,
right,
with the little bases. That's true. The thing I will say reverse of that is that on the bigger bases, especially if you're deep striking onto, say, for example, an Imperial Knight, and you need to split an arc line. You know, that's one of those things. From a tactical perspective, if you deep strike, for example, I bring in a drop pod as a 5-man tactical squad. I've got a melty gun and a combi melt on the sergeant. I disembark 6 inches. If I can get onto the line from his front armor to his side armor, the rules say that I, as the shooting player, get to draw my line of fire from any point on my model, right? And so, beginning of the shooting phase, I say, what side is your shield set on? He says, it's going to be set on the side. And I say, okay. Subsequent to that, I'll say, I'm going to shoot into your front armor because I can draw a line of fire from this model into your front arc because he's literally standing on the dividing line, right? It's a little gamey, but it happens all the time. And by rule, it is absolutely fair and balanced. You can draw into whichever arc you'd like to. And on those big bases, it's hugely advantageous. And not just that. It also helps with spacing. You know, those big bases are, if you want to engage as many models as possible, it's really nice. I think you could probably ask just about any demon player, especially with the advent of the Khorne.
Oh my God, yeah. The Hellhound, dogs on 50 mil bases look great.
Dogs on the big bases, not only do they look great, but they're better functionally because mm-hmm. the bigger base means you get to occupy more space, engage more models.
It's hard for a battle cannon to take out any now. You know, it's
absolutely. Same thing with the Marines on 32s. I mean, if you go to max coherency, you know, historically I still might be able to get 3 Marines or 4 Marines at max coherency on the 25s. Now that's not going to happen because you know you're. The left to right, the full diameter distance of a max coherency unit added about 2.5 inches by going from 25 to 32. So,
I'm anyway, still not sure who gave Ricky that advice.
Wasn't you?
But it's sound advice.
Have you ever heard the rap song, It Wasn't Me? There's literally a rap song called It Wasn't Me. Yeah,
it's a Shaggy tune.
I'm gonna link it to you, Paul.
Shaggy's one and only song.
Shaggy, exactly.
Oh, but now,
what kind of show are we doing tonight, Paul? That we are talking about 32 millimeter bases like it's a year ago, and talking about Shaggy
like it's 1993.
Dude, episode 169 is unpredictable, man. You never know what's happening.
That that guy made $1 billion off of one stupid song.
I think he had two or three.
It was a catchy song.
I think he had two or three. I was going through this White Dwarf, though. That's where we're kind of... Well, the thing that gets me... Because it's all... The bases are in here, and they feature the hero bases. Because now they've got the generic squad basing, and now they've got your hero basing. And, you know, a couple of them are, like, on your giant steps or whatever. Like, I don't know if I'd want to trust that I didn't roll the right power on my guy who's now can't hide behind anything on the table. but whatever.
On the whole, though, like, I mean, I'm going to stock them, and I'll probably use a couple of them. But I like...
They look
I like
great.
What GW's doing with all the bases, the texture paints, and all that stuff because, you know, it's just you get to be more creative. You know, before it was like, well, let's go, you know, to Secret Weapon. Let's go to, whichever other place I've ordered bases from. And let's pick out which theme I'm going to stick with, you know, and do my whole army on. And then you pay all that money for resin bases. And now you just go buy a couple of these texture paints and maybe one or two of these hero bases, and you get to do more with a hobby. You know, you get to basically paint on your scenic base with all these texture paints, throw some of the grass tufts down. Now they've got snow. I mean, it's just all these options we have now for bases.
All from the same store. It's all – I mean, that's – you can get it all from
exactly.
pretty much the same spot, which has value. They go over the – custodes and stuff in here too. There's things where the 30K rules for custodes are, and man, they're really committed to calling this guy Grigor the Fell-Handed.
Can I stop you right there 1 second? Yeah. I was asked by a listener to inform you that it's custodes. Continue. Well,
consider myself informed.
No kidding. One of my buddies, he's like, Ricky, could you inform the crew that it's custodies? And I was like, I will let them know.
But the custodian,
I expect no change.
The custodian guard are featured in this, as well as the Space Wolves. I love all the equipment that comes with these squads is really nice. I like all the options, and I used to collect Power Fist, and every time that a new Power Fist would come out, I need to get two or three of the new Power Fist so I could make my squads look a little bit different.
Right.
And I'm loving that stuff is like they got Thunder Hammers, more Power Fist, Lightning Claws. I mean, it's a modeler's kind of dream, my type of modeler's dream, where you know you have the options of building things up in this, and it's really cool. But this Fell-Handed guy, who is apparently somebody we should all know about, who we've never heard of before, and so I'm still not sure how I feel about that.
Wait, about the model or no, the fact that we should know who this guy is that we don't?
Yeah, picking out who I think is a random person I don't think he's been in any of the books, has he?
Don't ask me, man. I'm a Dark Angels player. Yeah. Like this is borderline heresy for me talking about this.
Don't admit that in public.
You shut your
hole. Not on this show.
I know, right? Sorry, Sanguinius is awesome. Yay! Can I still end the show? Okay, there we go. Continue.
All right. Well, the model is beautiful, and I'm sure he has great stats. Yes. I'm still not sure who he is, but I will play with him or use his bits to the best of my ability one way or another.
All right. Hey, I Googled this for you, Paul.
Yep.
The only source that I can find of is it Geiger Fell-Hand, is the Horus Heresy Burning of Prospero. So,
yep.
So far, Lexiconum doesn't have any other citation for this guy. So, well,
the miniature looks bad to the bone. We all know that. I'm not telling you anything nobody knows. It is a great miniature.
Is that Celtic, like those, that rope design in the Lightning Claw, is that modeled on there or was that free-handed on the...
I haven't opened up my figure box set yet. But I'm imagining that it is modeled on there.
I'm gonna need that.
He will make an amazing sanguinary high priest.
Oh my god! I'm gonna put him on Dark Angel just to piss you off.
It's not gonna make me mad. You do whatever you want. You're a toy. the last thing I'll talk about from this, although again they got a 2-page spread, they talk about Dark Eldar in here. Draw your own conclusions about why they might be relevant. But they also intone the Land Raider, the mighty Land Raider, into the Hall of Fame, the Miniature Hall of Fame.
And may it stay there forever, because that's the only place it's useful.
We were talking a little bit before the show about the uses that Land Raiders used to occupy, which were bringing down Titans, like the dual
last. Are you serious about that?
In the fluff.
That, in, yeah,
we
in
were
the fluff.
Joking, right?
Okay.
Cool.
Well, in Epic, you would take like a squad of 10 Land Raiders to go and take down a Titan or something like that. Some ratio of one Titan to multi Land Raiders.
Because that's not what they do now.
Well, so when the Land Raider first came out, it was amazing. I'm talking about like 20 years ago, whenever it first came out. Not 20, but some long time ago, where all we had were some Rhinos, and then we get this. And the Falcon was out. Falcon's beautiful for the Eldar. But then we get the Land Raider. And the Land Raider's got all these moving parts. It's got, you know, the ramp that opens and closes on the front if you wanted it to. All the hatches. The last cannons. Now, I don't know a single person, like, locally that built their last cannons on the back door hatches.
I mean, when I bought my very first Land Raider, I had a good buddy of mine who was kind of introducing me to the game and was teaching me the game. He was like, again, this is pre-grav, which is why he didn't tell me to not buy one altogether. But he was like, make sure you put your weapons in the back doorway. Don't do it the picture or what all the, you know, the online fluff, you know, drawings show. You want the guns in the back so that your guys can get out of the front hatches. And I was like, oh, cool. Thanks for that pro tip. But yeah, if somebody didn't counsel you on that, you probably put your guns in the front.
Wait. So what you're saying, Andrew, is the exact opposite of what I have.
No, you put the guns on the front. Just
put them on the front because you're hosing yourself out of like an inch of range.
Oh, only on the Land Raider Crusaders, that's correct.
On all the Land Raiders.
No.
Yes.
Why would you put – okay, let's imagine you are a Space Marine and it's time to deploy out of your Land Raider. It's in the heat of battle. Do you want to jump out in front of the last cannon?
Mm-mm. Probably not.
You don't.
I'm saying I totally agree with you guys when it comes to Land Raider Crusader and Redeemer. But on the
I'm sorry, you guys. Here's the thing: what looks better, and what looks better is guided by what could actually work. Because Space Marines are supposed to be highly intelligent, guided by the Omnissiah and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff, and the God Emperor. Sure, they would step out in front of a last cannon. They're tough MFers. But what looks better is when the last cannons are mounted in the back. If you mount them in the front, I think it's gamey, personally, number one. Number two, it looks dumb. It just doesn't look right.
I mean, so again, we have to define our terms here. Because for a Land Raider Crusader, I think there's no question you put the guns in the front. But for the Godhammer, for the last cannons one, you put it in the back. Because that inch and a half of range doesn't matter when you have a 48-inch gun. It usually doesn't matter. And that's not like hail of bullets style weaponry, right? And like very often, especially, I mean, for anybody who's played Land Raiders, especially in assault heavy armies, deploying all of your dudes out becomes a problem. It becomes, it's tight. That's
because you get hit in the face with the last cannon in Andrew's world.
All right. Well, listen, there's some debate on this here episode 169. Some people prefer it to be back to front. Others prefer front to back. And I'm not saying which one is better. I think it's equally great for everyone involved.
It's the podcast divided right here. This is. The real vote is right here. But I will point out, Paul, if you'll look on page 45 there, that picture in the top right, the last cannons on the Land Raider are in the front. Just so supported by Paul.
To me, you put the last cannons in the back, but the Crusader weapons or the Redeemer weapons go up front. But again, we're talking about a model that nobody should be buying or playing with. They're terrible.
But that's why it's fun to talk about these details.
I don't disagree. Yes, it is fun, but for real, like, because I get messages every week on Facebook and email and whatever else from people who listen to the show who are like, hey, you guys were talking about XYZ list or XYZ army, and your input was really cool, and I wanted to talk to you about this. And I like to think that people actually trust what we're saying on this show, and I just want to be emphatic that nobody should be playing with Land Raiders because they are terrible. So just don't take this conversation as an admonition to play with them.
I agree with you on that. All kidding aside.
For our fluff players. for our fluff players, like Andrew and I have talked about, and it's actually, it could potentially be powerful if it had Torrent, but the Blood Angels listed for Task Force, three Land Raiders getting a scout move and turbo boosters and all that.
Well, we're not going to fix the Land Raider on this podcast.
We're not going to fix it.
There are ways to make it effective.
Right. My point was, Andrew doesn't hate the Land Raider, and bring it if you want to. He's not speaking ill of it, but like, if you're going to a tournament, it's not going to do you any good.
The Strike Force Ultima rule isn't bad. That he gets an extra shot.
I think it's real good.
Yeah. So that,
I think we can close that this whole argument out with if you want a Land Raider, buy it, put it together, put it on a shelf, and then if you want to play with a Land Raider, get a Spartan and be done.
I mean,
Land Raider's in the Hall of Fame now.
It's in the Hall of Fame. And that's it's a great article though. It's like super fun because I love the model. I've got two Land Raiders. Well, they're on a shelf now, but I love the model. They're super fun to put together, and it's been one of my favorite tanks in 40K. It's one of all of our favorite tanks in 40K because it's so iconic to Space Marines. It's cool.
Yep.
It's just a bummer.
I listened to FDN, and they told me to play with Land Raiders.
Shut up. Nobody's going to say that.
Wasn't me.
Just go all in there. That's all I'm saying. Get the Warhammer World Command Land Raider and Rhino.
There Land you go. Raiders. The Land Raiders in the White Dwarf Hall of Fame wasn't me. I didn't do it. I had nothing to do with that.
We're almost out of time here. I mean, we've talked a solid hour on this. We have not covered the finishing move segment.
And we didn't talk a lick about Warzone.
What are we doing? Anything important?
Warzone coverage will be there.
One thing, Paul, when Jared Lane brings his Raven Guard to Warzone, you tell him how great the Sakaran looks because I painted it twice now.
I saw both attempts. Can we talk about Rich's mistakes?
Shut up.
So I will say this about Warzone real quick on a serious competitive note. And I know that Paul's trying to sign us off, but I want to say this because it's interesting to me, you know, as Warzone, we're only in our second year. We haven't even finished our second event, but it has been in large part due to how successful the first one was. And for whatever reasons, it's kind of groundswelled into a major GT that people are talking about on the worldwide internet webs. It's amazing to me to read the comments, whether it's Facebook, other blogs online, DACA, and the rest of it. When people are talking about the event and the restrictions or lack thereof get brought up, the reaction to Warzone being a full-fledged, unedited 7th edition Warhammer 40K tournament.
Rulebook 40K.
It really reminds me, I think, how lucky we are. Or not lucky, but like how great of an event it is. People are losing their minds about like, you can bring Come the Apocalypse allies. I can bring Warlord, Lords of War, super heavies. Nothing's edited. The Space Marine powers aren't hit with a nerf bat, invisibility works, you can get a 2-up rerollable invuln save. The whole, all of the chicken littling stuff in the 40K universe that people freak out about, and that ITC, for example, has just nerfed incredibly, right, is legal. Everyone freaks out about it, and I always remind them, we're playing 7th edition. We are the only. This is the only major GT in America that plays 7th edition 40K. Everyone else plays some like 40K. Weird personalized hybrid of it. And I really hope, and it's my earnest and sincere hope, that once again everyone will leave this event saying, "Wow, that was really a fun event. It was fantastic. I got to play with all of the models I wanted to play with. I got to bring my Brass Scorpion. I got to ally Cody Az with my Zombie Horde." Whatever you want to do, and you still had a fantastic, fun 40K event, and those restrictions aren't really needed. The sky will not crumble. The sun will come up. 7th edition 40K is a tremendously fun game if people just give it the chance. And I think Warzone is awesome because we're the only event playing 7th edition.
You need a lot of things really to be in place, a lot of things to go right to make this happen. Sometimes the feel and the style of the event really helps, you know, of course, which we put a lot of effort into. And but you're right about that. This kind of unfiltered 40K where our only concessions that we've made is to protect the experiences of whatever the middle tables are at the time. That's the only that's been the mandate, is like, how do we keep people having a good time the whole weekend? And the answer was not about changing how something works in one of their codexes. You know, it was with very minimal things to us.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, super minimal. Like, okay, you can't bring more than one super heavy. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, that rule is, put it this way, I was very, very, very upset with Kelly, with Paul, with Steven, the guys, the guys who made that rule.
Because you wanted to bring what?
Because I wanted to bring two Malkador tanks.
Which would have been completely bonkers.
Yeah, right, exactly. 600 points of Imperial Guard AV-13 tanks. Lord, no. But, you know, but I was like, I only bring that up to say that I was really upset that this restriction, which is not in the rule book, was imposed upon us, because I was like, this is not how we play. You can bring whatever you want. And Kelly and Paul were quick to point out, they said, well, we're trying to protect the experience of the middle tables, and we're trying to – and so, like, they made this, in my opinion, now that upon reflection, very minor restriction that says, well, yeah, you can't bring more than one Wraith Knight. You can't bring more than one Aunar Supremacy suit.
Big deal, right?
Yeah, exactly. And to me, that was like the sky was falling, how restrictive that was. And then when you get on to Bolter and Chainsword or DACA or Facebook or any one of those comment blog sites, and people are like, you're allowed to bring a Super Tuna at all? You can bring Come of the Apocalypse allies? People freak out. Unlimited sources? Unlimited detachments? What do you mean you can bring four sources in a single list? And I'm like, that is the most basic stuff. We see that every single yep. week. That's the game. That's 40K.
The funny thing is that, like, the people that are bringing like six sources and a town are probably not the people that are going to win the event. It's not a superior list.
You've hit the nail on the head, and then I'll wrap up with this. I think that my original impetus for starting this conversation was this. I think that people, especially first time attendees who didn't come to Warzone last year and aren't unfamiliar with how the Southeast plays 40K, when they show up, they've never the top tier 40K players, quote unquote top tier 40K players in America, have never played 7th edition 40K competitively.
No, they haven't.
They've never seen a Taunar Supremacy suit on the table against them. They don't know how it works. They've never seen all of the things that ITC has nerfed, they're unexperienced with. And I think that it's going to be a very rude, not rude awakening, but it's going to be an eye-opener for a lot of the players who are first-time Warzone attendees who come and have this experience and have a great time and really love the event because of the spirit and the culture surrounding it. And they're going to say, wow, this unmitigated 40K is actually a lot of fun. It's a wide open world.
Wasn't too bad.
It's not too bad. Not too bad.
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, Forge.
That's my hope. That's my true hope.
Forge Narrative has been preaching that since before Warzone existed. I mean, that's a huge reason why I went to the first Forge Narrative seasonal that I went to. Is the second time that I got to, you know, drink moonshine with Andrew Whitaker in a parking lot. You know, it never happened.
In the middle of a blizzard.
Wasn't me.
Let's go ahead and wrap this up. There's going to be plenty. We're going to be doing a lot of FTN broadcasting over the weekend, whether that be on the web. We'll try to get a few audio things out. I know we were kind of all over the map in this episode, and we didn't quite get to like a legitimate finishing move section, although we did talk a lot about hobby stuff throughout the show. We will do two finishing move sections on the next episode.
Also, I feel like that's probably an empty promise. I'm not going to call Paul Murphy a liar here, but in all likelihood, next week is just going to be all Warzone recap. So you might not have to wait for a couple of weeks.
It'll be a long episode.
Yeah, there it is.
Extended.
Extended.
That's right. Bonus.
Oh, and Sign us off, Paul. Let's get out of here.
Okay.
Have a good day, anyway, team.
Hope everyone has a good night tonight. Good luck this weekend if you are coming to join us in Atlanta. Be looking for all the content. If I know what the links are before I get this posted, I'll put them in there. But it'll definitely be on the Forge Narrative Facebook page and the Warzone Atlanta Facebook page where you can find all the info, how to check in on us over the course of the weekend. Hope you guys have a good night.
Good night,
good night everybody.
Why is the rum gone?